The Horse Race is brought to you by Benchmark Strategies. Benchmark is setting a new standard as Boston's fastest growing public affairs consulting firm. To know more, connect with Benchmark on Twitter at Benchmark Boston.
This week on The Horse Race, we dive into the state of polling nationwide and here in Massachusetts. Then, the gig worker debate is picking up steam at the Statehouse. We'll look at what both sides want. It's Thursday, March 23rd.
Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Steve Cazella, here with my co-host Jennifer Smith, and Lisa Kaczynski will be joining us later in today's show. Jen, spring is officially upon us. It's over 50 degrees. Congratulations to you for surviving yet another ominously warm winter here in Massachusetts. So many good things happening.
I would like to say that there is a story that has been kicking around across different news platforms about how obviously, ominously, horribly warm this winter has been. But some of them include really haunting photos of melting snowmen, where someone has apparently scraped up the tiny little vestiges of snow that might have gathered at varying points outside their Massachusetts homes, built tiny snowmen, and then the 50 degree unseasonably warm weather has just been melting them away. So I would just like to petition all of the reporters out there to pick less freaky images for their weather stories.
I have sympathy there because that's one of the ways you keep your kids entertained with even like a half inch of snow is just let them roll whatever they can find in the yard into a ball and stack it on top of others. But melting snowmen is not the only story that we have here today, Jen. Sharp listeners of The Horse Race will realize that we've been introducing Jen as Commonwealth Magazine's Jennifer Smith for the last few weeks. Several have noted it on Twitter. I think maybe for some it just sort of went past, as most of The Horse Race does. But Jen, this is news. You are now working for Commonwealth Magazine.
Yes, I'm delighted to report that we can now break the news from one of the possibly worst kept secrets in Massachusetts politics and journalism, which is that I have started at Commonwealth Magazine. I am replacing Shira Schoenberg, which is possibly the biggest shoes anyone could have to fill on the state government level, but I'm going to do my level best at it. And that just means that, Steve, once again, sorry to report, it is you up against two full-time journalists on this year's podcast. Do you feel outmatched?
I'll say that it is good to have two journalists on my team. How about that?
That's fine. Don't phrase it as combative. Be that person.
It's also exciting and happy news for me, just because for those who don't know, Commonwealth is actually published by Mass Inc. And Mass Inc. is the parent company of the Mass Inc. Polling Group. So it means that Jen and I actually work under, I guess, what would have probably at one point been called the same roof, though now virtual roof, virtual bunkers. You know, we all work wherever we want to work these days, but we're at least all in the same organization now.
Yeah, that's right. Steve gets to be in the in-office bunker studio and I get to be in the remote bunker studio. But technically, it's the same studio in spirit.
The news did finally make it to Twitter over the last few days. But as another thing that we want to discuss here at the top, fewer and fewer people seem to be seeing the things that are making it to Twitter. Lisa had a big story in Playbook this morning. Jen, what did you notice about it?
I mean, it's really just kind of the top line vibes of this story, isn't it? Just that Massachusetts Twitter spaces have kind of been hollowed out, at least in spirit. You know, the Mapley, and yes, we still insist that that is the pronunciation because of Steve's very scientific poll years ago. And the Boss Poly hashtags for state and Boston politics are really just kind of down in engagement. And I think maybe for most of us who spend a lot of time on there, we've really felt it not feel quite as like vibrant or energized as it used to. But I haven't really gotten a strong sense of why. There were a few kind of ideas kicking around in the top of Lisa's Playbook this morning about, you know, maybe it's sort of this time of year, no one's really budget mad. But also, you know, a third fewer tweets were sent per day and a third many accounts are using these hashtags during budget week compared to 2021. So I don't know, did the pandemic chase everyone off of Massachusetts Twitter, Steve?
This article kind of gave numbers to some of the things that I've been feeling, at least on Twitter over the last few months. as you said, you know, seeing a third fewer tweets compared to the same time last year, and also the observation that the people who are tweeting tend to be more politicians and journalists and less everyday people. It's hard to really think back in what Twitter used to feel like even 4 or 5 years ago, where it was just people in Boston, people around Boston, people in Massachusetts, just everyday people that would come on and talk to you about things and be interested in things. And I'm not saying that everything was great back then, because certainly there was plenty of toxicity. You know, Michelle Wu noted that as the reason that she took a break from Twitter earlier this year. But there were just more regular people. And also, the other thing that seems like it's changed in the last few months is either everybody that I know has gotten way less interesting, or Twitter has done something to change how people see your tweets, or whether they retweet it, or whether they like them. Because we all kind of talk about it in a slightly embarrassing, I guess, to say, like, boy, my likes have really gone down. You know, what am I? I'm not like a teenager who's making a living on TikTok or something like that. But you do notice it. And we do spend a lot of time on it. And it has actually been, for many of us, very professionally valuable over the years, even with all of the complaining that we do about it. You know, the people that we've met, the people that we know, you know, the fact that this podcast even exists, you know, a lot of that actually does have to do with Twitter. So to sort of see it just slowly dying off, which is how it feels, is, I think, worth stopping and taking note of.
Absolutely, even if it means there's not kind of an obvious place to go to if it turns out that there is sort of a dwindling effect. The last thing that I think was interesting to bring up from Playbook this morning was the question of what this also means for campaigns, because if it remained this sort of insular political journalist sphere, that's sort of one thing, but it was for many years a pretty effective tool for kind of building enthusiasm around campaigning. And that means that folks are going to have to figure out ways to really diversify their reach. We know if you want to reach the Republicans, you just go to Facebook. You can basically bypass Twitter. But if you're in Massachusetts and trying to run a Democratic campaign and Twitter is suddenly the most boring place in town to be for the average person, now you've got a problem.
Yep. So I think the only solution is that every campaign needs to try to start a TikTok dance craze. There's really no other option.
Oh, Steve.
So take note, campaign managers. This is what we expect from you. But Jen, that brings us to the time of the show where we ask the existential yet simple and confounding question all at once, which is, can we please, for the love of God, start talking about polling?
Steve, I know that it physically hurts you when we go for more than 3 minutes without talking about polling. And fortunately for you and for our listeners, we can start talking about polling right about now, because Nate Silver and his team at 538 came out with an updated list of their pollster rankings earlier this month. We'll take an in-depth look at what they found. Steve is probably going to sound very rightfully proud of himself. Let's get into it, shall we?
Let's do it.
Listeners, do you remember way back in 2016 when people were ready to leave the polls and the pollsters for dead? Well, as a new article from 538 points out, the demise of the polling industry once again has been greatly exaggerated. In fact, 2022 was one of the best years for polling that we've ever seen, apparently. Now, granted, some polls were more accurate than others, but fortunately for us here in Ye Olde Commonwealth, Massachusetts has a virtual all-star lineup of state-level polling, and even more fortunately for our listeners of this podcast, we have a very important guest to talk about it, my co-host, and for those of you who don't know, the president of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, Steve Cazella. Steve, this is your chance to talk about polls. What sticks out to you most in the updated ratings list?
I've been waiting for this. I've been waiting for my chance to talk about polls all this time. No, seriously, 538 did just come out with this assessment. And basically what it is they measure how accurate the polls were. And what they mean by that is they look at presidential polls, they look at Senate polls, and they look at gubernatorial polls and House polls, I should say, House of Representative polls also. And what they're trying to figure out is how close were the polls that were released in a certain window right before Election Day to what actually happened. So they have that window to avoid the problem of, okay, well, you did a poll 6 months ago before one of the candidates announced, and hey, it was wrong. You know, obviously, you shouldn't measure on that. You should measure polls that take place within a certain period of the election day. They choose 21 days. So based on that time frame, the polls were quite accurate this year, which, as you said, gives us another 2 years of life.
Well, for the question of accuracy, I mean, not everyone knows exactly what you mean by that when you talk about an accurate poll. So how do you decide if a poll is accurate?
Well, there is a lot of controversy about this, actually. And the story of how accuracy is determined actually begins well before 2022 and really well before 2016. So Nate Silver, the person who runs 538 and who started 538 back in 2008, did what pretty much was an elaborate averaging of polls at the state level and national level to predict what was going to happen in the presidential election at that time. And the measure that he used and the measure that 538 still uses, though it's evolved to a certain extent, is basically the margin between candidate A and candidate B. So if you have a poll that has Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in it, and your poll says, for instance, that Hillary Clinton is going to win by 4, and instead Donald Trump wins by 4 in that state, for instance, then your poll was off by 8 points. Now, we should expect that polls are off a little bit. Each poll is going to have some amount of error unless you just happen to get lucky and nail exactly what happened. But that is essentially how accuracy has been measured. And that was really successful for the beginning time of when people were starting to pay attention to that and thinking, hey, we've got all these polls. We could just roll them up just like Nate Silver did and come up with these super scientific sounding percentage odds that each candidate's going to win in each place and roll that up even further to say, okay, here's the percentage odds that a presidential candidate's going to win because of, you know, which states they're going to win and so forth. So it created this whole, you know, ecosystem of forecasters and, you know, polling observers that were, you know, basically started in some ways by what Nate Silver was doing.
I mean, there is sort of an almost horror movie setup to that, which is this was the promise. How did it actually go?
Well, you know, for a little while, it went pretty well, at least as far as predicting the outcomes of elections. Now, there's certainly debate about whether or not that's a good way to decide whether a pollster is doing a good job. You know, the task of identifying what a likely voter is, for instance, which is what pollsters are trying to do when they're taking a survey and asking people who they have decided in the, using their own methods is someone who's likely to turn out in the election, who are you going to vote for? You know, that process is fraught with peril. You know, there's a million different ways of doing it. Those ways have evolved. And you don't know until after the election whether the way that you have been doing it actually worked out pretty well. You know, who are you going to call about asking? You know, is it people who have voted in the past? Is it more young people this year? Is it irregular voters who are just going to show up because this year is going to be a big wave election? Do you ask super consistent set of questions that always identifies who's likely to vote? You know, it's worked different ways for different elections, and pollsters sometimes have overlearned the wrong lessons and then tried to make the adjustment, and then the election after that turns out somewhat differently. In essence, the problem or the challenge is you're trying to project a world that doesn't exist yet. You're trying to project, okay, this is the electorate that is going to exist. I'm going to ask you a question about things that you're planning to do. But, you know, humans aren't always great at figuring out what they're going to do. So that's a really hard thing. And then the other thing that's happened in recent years is that communications methods have shifted. You know, up until 2008 and rapidly shifting after that, most polls were done using landlines, landline telephones. And you could call, you know, a series of numbers and get with that series of numbers a pretty random sample of what of who lived in each place, and then ask them a series of questions. But first with cell phones, and then with people stopping even answering the cell phones, you know, that pattern has really shifted.
Well, it seems like 2016, and maybe to some extent 2020, felt like kind of big pivot points. Like there was a real instinct or eagerness to whack pollsters for not exactly predicting something that would turn out, as opposed to, you know, saying this is kind of a snapshot, this is a possibility. And they were pretty good, actually, at predicting the outcomes in both of those races, if I understand. So what happened over that 4-year period of time? People really seem to be having a great time kind of dancing on pollsters' graves, in theory, even if that wasn't matching the reality.
I think there were a few things. And one of them was that, particularly in 2016, lots of people, lots of journalists were looking for someone to blame, you know, looking for someone to explain why the world missed that this was coming. And the polls, and really the polls as described by the forecasts, I think gave that culprit, you know, sort of presented a ready-made culprit for that. The forecasters actually had a pretty wide range of possibilities that were shown. You know, some actually did have Hillary Clinton has a 99% chance of winning, but others said Hillary Clinton has a 65% chance of winning. And the thing that can sometimes be confusing about that, or that is often misinterpreted, is people say, oh, well, she's way ahead. She has a 65% chance of winning. Where what that actually means is Trump has, you know, basically 1 in 3 chance of winning, or like a really good major league hitter's chance of getting a hit. You know, you don't expect them to, a good hitter to get up and say, well, they're never going to get a hit. Their batting average is only 350. Like, that's a really good hitter, you know, and people, I think, kind of misinterpreted that a little bit. However, you know, when you look at the measure that the polls are now doing well at, which is how well did they do at predicting the margin, the final margin, not very well in 2016. You know, 2016 and to a lesser extent 2020 were not great years for overall polls. The problem specifically in 2016 was that the places where they were the worst were the states that mattered the most, you know, the swing states, basically. So if you think, okay, well, what's a forecaster doing? They're looking at the states that matter the most. They're looking at Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, all the states that have a chance of kind of flipping back and forth. And that's one of the things that led to some of the forecasts saying, you know, Clinton had a 99% chance of winning.
So where does that leave us now? 2022 seems like it was actually a pretty good year.
Well, that's a good question. And it's hard to say exactly, because polling has a really long redemption cycle when you do poorly, and you get to ride on your momentum for a while when you do well. So after 2016, you know, pollsters were like, okay, well, we're going to fix this. But it's not, you continue our baseball analogy, it's not like you can just get up again next inning and take another swing at it. It's like you have 2 years to figure out, are all these changes that I've made doing anything? Did I correctly diagnose the issue and so forth? But the thing that brings me some comfort, or perhaps optimism, is that the years that were the worst were 2016 and to a lesser extent 20. And maybe it was something specific about those years, Donald Trump's candidacy. And when you look at 2018 and 2022, when he wasn't on the ballot, things were better. So maybe it isn't that something's fundamentally and permanently wrong with polling. You know, and then the other thing that brings me, I think, you know, joy and optimism, and particularly for this podcast, is that Massachusetts is great. You know, the polling here is really, really solid. One of the things that the new rating showed was that a whole range of pollsters in Massachusetts are doing really, really good stuff. You know, Beacon Research, for instance, does the Fox News poll. They're right across the street from Ye Olde Bunker. You know, Emerson and Suffolk are right downtown as well. Suffolk was one of the most accurate pollsters in the country this last year. You know, UMass Lowell is doing great work. Western New England University, also UMass Amherst, just lots and lots of good state polling. And then, of course, us at the Massing Polling Group. So I'm, you know, very happy with kind of what's going on in Massachusetts. And I think cautiously optimistic that maybe pollsters nationwide are set for a little bit easier time than we've had lately.
Well, I can't let you go without asking you to, as all pollsters are asked, make an absolutely irresponsible prediction about the future based on what you've said so far, which is there's still the open question, as you referenced, about whether or not Donald Trump is going to run again. So if it turns out that the common denominator in kind of uneven polling might be this wild card at the national level, does that mean you're looking ahead at 2024 and going, oh, no, not again?
Possibly, yes, I'd say possibly. You know, that's one theory about what's kind of gone wrong. You know, pollsters, I think, did better in 20 than in 16, and perhaps that's some evidence that they figured out some part of it. Pollsters have also figured out much more about communication methods and kind of how to deal with the fact that some people will answer online, some people will answer a text message, some people will answer a live phone call, and so forth, and, you know, factor that in too. So I wouldn't say it's, you know, as concerning as it might have been if all those other changes hadn't been made. But certainly something that we'll be thinking about and something we'll be keeping an eye on if Trump does become the nominee again.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have to talk about polling. I'm so sorry, Steve. I promise we'll come back to it in the future. For now, my co-host, president of Massing Polling Group, Steve Gazella, thank you so much to talk about the state of polling in Massachusetts.
I'm always glad to talk about polling, Jen.
It should be news to no one listening to this here pod that the gig worker classification question has been a point of serious disagreement in Massachusetts and across the country. From coast to coast, ride-hailing companies, labor unions, politicians, and voters have been struggling to establish whether gig workers are normal employees, independent contractors, or some sort of third category. Jen, you and I have both spent some time on the different bills, ballot measures, court rulings, you name it, across all these states, trying to unwind this issue. So let's start with Massachusetts, of course. How did we get here?
Well, here, fortunately, seems to be very close to both of us, which is Beacon Hill, but it's been kind of a winding road up till this point. As voters might recall, over the last few years, there was a real push to basically settle the question of whether or not gig workers are independent contractors and therefore not entitled to certain state-mandated protections, going back to, actually, the Attorney General, former Attorney General, now Governor Maura Healey, suing the rideshare ride-hailing companies Uber and Lyft, arguing that the way that they treat their employees as independent contractors violated the specific provision in state law that lays out these rules for who can actually count as an independent contractor. So we saw that lawsuit move forward, and instead of kind of, you know, just sorting it out through the courts, the rideshare companies and a coalition around them decided to take it to the ballot. So there was a ballot campaign that would have basically put the question to voters saying, are we okay if we essentially say that rideshare employees are independent contractors with a certain set of benefits? So this is neither just saying these are normal employees and they are entitled to these state benefits, or they're independent contractors and therefore not technically entitled to much, but to carve out this sort of third camp. And this was not very popular with folks who would like these workers to be considered, you know, able to unionize, able to negotiate for fair wages or anything like that. So there was a lawsuit that went to our highest court, brought by, I suppose, another candidate for attorney general at the time, unsuccessfully, Shannon Liss Reardon, that was arguing that this particular ballot measure should be thrown out before it ever got to voters, because it was basically trying to jam too many things into this one ballot measure. So the SJC heard that, thought about it, looked at the actual text of the bill, and then said it was actually a bit too broad. It wasn't just saying here are some certain benefits for rideshare workers, but also it included language that was related to accident liability and contract formation. So arguing that this doesn't work with the way that we do ballot measures in Massachusetts, the highest court tossed it out. And that is how we are right back at where we might have started to begin with, which is with an active lawsuit from the Attorney General suing these companies and also possible compromise legislation on Beacon Hill.
So I'm going to ask you to back up in there a little bit, because I want you to explain who's on which side of this argument. And to touch on the fact that I feel like some people don't realize is that drivers are actually divided over this. There are drivers who have stood with both sides of this fight. So walk us through who the ringleaders are on both sides of this fight.
So in the simplest possible terms, you're looking at something that is a conflict between kind of the app companies and labor unions. Those are sort of the driving powerhouses behind both of these sides. But you note correctly that this is not really a cut and dry issue based on how any given, you know, driver for any of these services feels that their kind of job and flexibility would be most impacted by either being considered an independent contractor or considered kind of a normal standard employee. The argument made by kind of the app companies and riders associated with them in that sort of coalition is that keeping them or classifying them as independent contractors would be essential for maintaining sort of flexibility. It would let drivers be on multiple apps at once. The idea that it could kind of, you know, let them set their schedules, and that this would provide benefits that are not currently guaranteed to independent contractors under law. So that's the argument kind of for the independent contractor status. On the other side, you have basically labor movements who are saying that this is essentially a very expensive effort to disenfranchise and take away rights that these workers are already entitled to, that they are not independent contractors, and there's nothing about a standard definition of employment that means you couldn't have flexibility around hours, that you shouldn't be entitled to healthcare and basic benefits and that sort of thing. So it's basically come down to the question of, is there something interesting and specific about the gig economy that requires a different conception of employment?
And so other states have tried to answer this first. And part of the reason that this is news again in Massachusetts, and that there is some chatter about this early on in the session, is because of a recent court ruling in California. So take us back through that original 2020 ballot measure in California, what it said, what it was trying to achieve, and what's happened now.
So this is where I get to take advantage of my California native roots and make the case that we might want to care about something that's happening on the other side of the country, because California and Massachusetts had very similar laws when it comes to how you would classify who counts as an independent contractor. And there were lawsuits that looked very similar in both states, arguing that the way that these app companies were defining their workers was counter to literally pretty much those identical laws. Now, what happened in California back in 2020 is there was something called Proposition 22, which was a very, very expensive ballot measure that established that app-based gig workers were independent contractors and had that kind of same set of benefits that we were just talking about. The language looked very similar to the one that we later saw in Massachusetts. Now, it passed. It was a $200 million ballot question. I think the most expensive ballot measure in the history of the United States out there. It passed and then was challenged in court for reasons that might sound kind of similar to what I was talking about in Massachusetts, which is they said it was trying to do too many things and infringing on the legislature's ability to basically control benefits. They, in one part of the bill in Proposition 22, basically placed some restrictions on how the legislature could amend this law to allow for some sort of collective bargaining representation. And the trial court in California said that's not reasonably related to what people thought they were voting on. They thought they were voting on the idea that these were workers who were independent contractors and were giving them some benefits. They didn't necessarily think they were voting to limit their collective bargaining rights. So the trial court said this is conflicting with the kind of narrowness rules that we also have here in California. However, it just went up to the appeals court. It's probably going to make it up to the California Supreme Court. But the appeals court just restored a large part of the measure, saying, I do think these are actually reasonably related. I don't agree with the way that the trial court has conceptualized that question. And it left out some parts of it that did deal with how the legislature was able to amend the law. But for the most part, they've restored the Proposition 22 language. So that's where it stands in California right now. And so we over here in Massachusetts, if we're trying to figure out, you know, is there a potential for some other version of a ballot measure here? It just might be a little bit instructive if someone wanted to take another run at that windmill.
And they definitely are trying to take another run at that windmill. Big tech has basically used the California ruling to kind of fire another warning shot at Beacon Hill. There was a letter from the tech company trade group Chamber of Progress that was sent this week. I had it in Playbook if you want to take a look. Basically telling Beacon Hill to bring everyone to the table, all the stakeholders, all the sides of this, and to try and hammer out a compromise, you know, as they put it, to find, quote, common sense solutions to meet the needs of gig workers. To tech, of course, that's keeping them as independent contractors. So maybe not, again, everyone seeing eye to eye on this. But what the point of this is that they're trying to get this moving because there's kind of the spoken and unspoken warning here, and it was sort of spelled out, hinted at in this letter, that this is likely to end up in a ballot campaign again if the legislature doesn't act. And there are a lot of bills before the legislature right now that they could act on that would accomplish various things. So, Jen, do you want to take us through some of those too?
Let's go. Let's trade off on this one. I guess let's start out with the ones that you would say are kind of the progressive union-backed set of them. So there's two different sets of bills that are looking at establishing some particular rights for rideshare, ride-hailing drivers, or gig workers for app companies. One of them is called the Rideshare Drivers Justice Bill, and that one is specifically looking at the matter of collective bargaining rights. It's not trying to say we are establishing that these either are or aren't independent contractors, just that regardless of how you classify them, they should be able to move down the path to unionization. So this one is backed by the International Association of Machinists Union and the 32BJ SEIU unions. So two unions back that one. There is a different bill that would tackle classification and is supported by the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters, and the United Food and Commercial Workers. It aims to enforce the current state labor law and argues that rideshare workers are already entitled to these presumptions of employment and they should be considered employees. So that kind of pair of bills there, if it was successful, would end up saying not only are they not independent contractors, but they also have established collective bargaining rights. However, Lisa, as was implied by this setup, neither of these bills is really favored by the ride-hailing industry. There are two others.
Yes, one of them essentially closely mirrors the ballot measure that was tossed last year. And the other one seeks to create this portable benefit account that drivers could use, which is basically, as we've sort of talked through, the way in which they would be able to get some benefits while still being independent contractors. This was the thing that was floated as kind of the compromise part of this last year as this ballot battle was kind of shaping up, and they've brought it back again this year.
So how is this interacting, in your view, with the question of would there be another ballot measure?
Well, look, the legislature, as part of last year's ballot process, had the chance to act on this legislation. There is a part of this whole getting a measure on the ballot in which the legislature has the chance to act on something and reach a compromise to stop something from getting all the way to the ballot. And they didn't take it. They didn't want to touch this. And there's very little indication that they want to do that now, especially with, circling all the way back to the beginning of this conversation and this fight, the fact that the original attorney general who sued Uber and Lyft is now the governor. And while I had asked her about this a couple months ago, if a bill trying to make these gig workers, ride-hailing app drivers, independent contractors, landed on her desk as governor, would she veto it? And she, you know, took the line of, we'll review any legislation that comes to our desk, etc. But you have to imagine that, you know, the fact that she sued them in the first place is going to weigh heavily on her mind if something makes it there and is now weighing heavily on the legislature as they decide what they want to do this session.
Absolutely. And for anyone tracking the lawsuit that has been picked up by Attorney General Andrea Campbell, it's been in the deposition phase for a while now. It's been in discovery. So all of the documents that Uber and Lyft have to turn over have to get over to the AG's office by the end of the month. And they're going to be doing depositions through the spring. So that is your update on the current status of the gig workers bills. Lisa, do you think we should leave it there or spend another 3 hours on this?
Oh, I think we'll have another 3 hours to spend. What is that you said? Later this spring into the summer? We'll definitely be riding back around to this one.
And that brings us to our final segment this week, which is historical firearm accidental discharge segment, which we, I would say, occasionally do, but actually this is the first time. Jen, something, am I reading this right that a musket went off in a museum?
I am so sorry to have to say yes. There's this great little Globe story about a deeply Massachusetts sort of incident inside the Westford Museum over the weekend, where there was a member of the 6th Middlesex Regiment reenactment group. They were holding a meeting at the museum and someone fired a shot out of the muskets, and they obviously weren't supposed to have live ammunition. But on top of that, the museum director said the meeting was also supposed to be outside. So you did end up, again, no one was injured. We can kind of smile about it because no one was injured. But Maybe check your historical muskets to make sure they are not loaded before you go inside a museum for a reenactment. Steve, was this part of your weekend plan?
Yeah, I just have a series of questions about this. I mean, the article says the projectile lodged in the ceiling beam and did not exit the building's second floor. The building sustained no structural damage. So this makes it sound like it was actually loaded inside and that somebody accidentally fired it, which is just wild on a whole series of levels.
I mean, wild on a whole series of levels is that is all the time we have for today. I'm Jennifer Smith, signing off with Steve Gazella and Lisa Kaczynski. Our producer, as always, is Adam Boyaji. Don't forget to give The Horse Race a review wherever you're hearing us now. Subscribe to the Massachusetts Politico Playbook and Commonwealth Magazine's Daily Download if you haven't already. And reach out to the Mass Inc. polling group if you need any polls done. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.